of the ceremony I had watched 5 months earlier, in the distant Tehama. For a fortnight the young men who were to be circumcised had danced each evening and late into the night, waiting for the day when the old men would announce that the positions of the moon and stars were favourable. The initiates wore short, tight-sleeved red jackets, and baggy white drawers, tight at the ankle, the only time in their lives when they wore drawers, which were women's dress. On the appointed day, riding on camels, they were paraded behind the musicians round the neighbouring villages, and then brought back just before sunset, followed by a large crowd to their own village. Their friends helped them to take off their drawers, and then, one after the other, these young men, looking like girls with their flowing hair and delicate features, stepped forward in front of their tribe. Each of them stood, with legs apart and his hands gripping his long hair, staring motionless and unflinching at a dagger stuck in the ground in front of him, while a slave handled his penis until it was erect, and then flayed the entire organ. When the slave stepped aside, his work at last completed, the lad sprang forward and, to the compelling rhythm of the drums, danced frenziedly before the eager, craning crowd, leaping and capering while the blood splashed down his legs. This is the modified form of a rite far older than Islam. In the Hajaz Mountains, some of the tribes still performed the flaying circumcision, which was often postponed until a man was married and had children, and in which the skin was removed from the navel down to the inside of the legs. Ibn Saud forbade even the modified form of this circumcision, which he declared was a pagan custom. But the young men were prepared to risk the severest punishment rather than forego the credit of submitting to this rite. On this particular occasion, one of them had already been circumcised as a child, but he insisted on undergoing the second operation. Even after it was over, their sufferings were not yet ended. Each morning, they were held down over a small hole in the ground, so that their mutilated parts dangled down, to kipper in the heat and smoke which came up from a fire below. Lads who had stood unmoved while they were circumcised screamed with the agony of this barbarous treatment. I described what I had seen to Bin Gabina, who said, "That is not circumcision, it is butchery." In the evening I gave Bin Gabina the clothes which I had brought for him, and the spare dagger which was in my saddlebag. He buckled it on with pride. A stranger would have thought that he should have expressed his gratitude, but this was not customary among Arabs. He had accepted my gift, and felt that there was no need for words. He would express his gratitude by other means. We left Chasseur on the 9th of November in the chill of dawn. The sun was resting on the desert's rim, a red ball without heat. We walked as usual till it grew warm, the camels striding in front of us, a moving mass of legs and necks. Then, one by one, as the inclination took us, we climbed up their shoulders and settled in our seats for the long hours which lay ahead. The Arabs sang, the full-throated roaring of the tribes. The shuffling camels quickened their pace, thrusting forward across the level ground, for we had left the hills behind us and were on the steppes which border on the sands. We noticed the stale tracks of oryx, saw gazelle bounding stiff-legged across the plain, and flushed occasional hares from withered salt bushes in shallow watercourses. Vinshuas told us how they had carried Marcin, who was his uncle, for 3 days tied on a camel, with the bone of his shattered thigh sticking through the skin, while they tried to outdistance the pursuers who followed in their tracks. Then Bin Matluk spoke of the raid in which young Sahail was killed. He and 14 companions had surprised a small herd of Saar camels. The herdsman had fired 2 shots at them before escaping on the fastest of his camels, and one of these shots had hit Sahail in the chest. Bakit held his dying son in his arms as they rode back across the plain with the 7 captured camels. It was late in the morning when Sahail was wounded, and he lived till nearly sunset, begging for water, which they had not got. They rode all night to escape from inevitable pursuit. At sunrise they saw some goats and a small Saar encampment under a tree in a shallow valley. A woman was churning butter in a skin, and a boy and a girl were milking the goats. Some small children sat under the tree. The boy saw them first and tried to escape, but they cornered him against a low cliff. He was about 14 years old, a little younger than Sahel, and he was unarmed. When they surrounded him, he put his thumbs in his mouth as a sign of surrender and asked for mercy. No one answered him. Bakit slipped down off his camel, drew his dagger, and drove it into the boy's ribs. The boy collapsed at his feet, moaning, "Oh, my father! Oh, my father!" And Bakit stood over him till he died. He then climbed back into his saddle, his grief a little soothed by the murder which he had just committed. As Bin Matluk spoke, staring across the level plain with his hot, rather bloodshot eyes, I pictured the scene with horrible distinctness. The small, long-haired figure in white loincloth crumpled on the ground, the spreading pool of blood, the avid clustering flies, the frantic wailing of the dark-clad women, the terrified children, the shrill, insistent screaming of a small baby. I rode along haunted by the thought of that murdered child, while around me the watchful Arabs formed and reformed into chattering groups. There was not one of them whose life would not be forfeit if we were surprised by Shah raiders. Vindictive as this age-old law of a life for a life and a tooth for a tooth might be, I realized, nonetheless, that it alone prevented wholesale murder among a people who were subject to no outside authority, and who had little regard for human life. For no man lightly involves his whole family or tribe in a blood feud. I remembered that, in 1935, Glubb, describing the Bedou of the North, had written, "It was curious to think that even in the anarchical days of raging tribal chaos in ungoverned Arabia, before the emergence of the Akhwan or the present establishment of law and order, there was probably less fear and apprehension abroad than there is today in peaceful England." It was easy to be shocked by the Bedou's disregard for human life. After all, many people feel today that it is morally indefensible to hang a man, even if he has raped and killed a child. But I could not forget how easily we ourselves had taken to killing during the war. Some of the most civilized people I had known had been the most proficient. The country grew more arid. Every plant and bush was dead. Skeletons of trees, brittle, powdery branches, fallen and half buried in the drifting sand, and deposits of silt left by ancient floods, but now as dry as ashes, marked the course of al-Hayt, the mother of life, the great trunk wadi which leads down to Mukshin. Nothing stirred, not even a lizard, for here there had been 25 years of unbroken drought. On the second day at sunset, we saw the sands stretching across our front, a shimmering rose-coloured wall, seemingly as intangible as a mirage. The Arabs, roused from the nodding torpor of weary, empty hours, pointed with their sticks, shouted, and broke into a sudden spate of talk. But I was content to look in silence upon that long-awaited vision, as excited as a mountaineer who sees above the Indian foothills the remote white challenge of the Himalayas. We rode parallel with the sands, since the hard gravel surface of the plain was easier for our camels than the soft steepness of the dunes. In the late afternoons, we usually turned in to the sands to camp. Large mimosa-like trees, which the Arabs called guff, grew here. Deep down, their questing roots had found water, and their branches were heavy with flowering, trailing fronds that fell to the clean sand and formed arbours in which we camped. One night, near Mukshin, when, sleeping on the open plain, I was awakened by a long-drawn howl. Again and again the uncanny sound quavered across the camp, sending shivers down my back. It came from a group of figures sitting 20 yards away. I called out, "What is wrong?" And Bin Kabina answered, "Said is possessed by a Zaha." I got up, walked round some camels, and joined them. By the light of the setting moon, I could see the boy, one of the Beit Katir, crouching over a small fire. His face and head were covered with a cloth, and he rocked himself to and fro as he howled. The others sat close to him, silent and intent. Suddenly they began to chant in two parts, while Said thrashed himself valiantly from side to side. More and more wildly he threw himself about, and once a corner of the cloth with which he covered his face fell into the embers and began to smoulder. Someone leant forward and put it out. Steadily the chanting rose and fell about the demented boy, who gradually became calmer. A man lit some incense in a bowl and held it under the boy's nose beneath the cloth. Suddenly he began to sing in a curious, strained, high-pitched voice. Line by line the others answered him. He stopped, grew violent again, and then calmed once more. A man leant forward and asked him questions, and he answered, speaking like someone in his sleep. I could not understand the words, for they spoke Mara. They gave him more incense, and the spirit left him. A little later he lay down to sleep, but once again he was troubled. This time he sobbed bitterly and groaned as if in great pain. They gathered round him once more and chanted until he grew calm. Then he slept. In the morning he was all right. The belief in possession by a czar or evil spirit is also widely held in the Sudan, Egypt, and Mecca, and is generally thought to have originated in Abyssinia or Central Africa. It seems to me possible that it originated in southern Arabia. My companions told me that whenever they exercised a czar, they used the Mahra tongue, and I knew that the ancestors of the Mahra had originally colonized Abyssinia. We reached Mukshin 8 days after leaving Shisur. We were approaching the well, and Marcin was telling us once more about the battle in which he had been wounded. His stiff leg was stretched out in front of him. Suddenly, unaccountably, our camels panicked, scattering in great plunging bounds. I saw a man fall from his camel in front of me as I fought to keep my seat. When my camel was under control, I looked back. Marcin lay crumpled and motionless on the ground. We ran back to him. His damaged leg was twisted under him, and he was moaning faintly. His headcloth had fallen off, and the close-cropped hair showed grey upon his skull. As I bent over him, I realized that he was older than I had thought. We tried to straighten him, but he screamed. I got morphia from my saddlebags and gave him an injection. And then we carried him on a blanket to the trees. By the grace of God, the well was close at hand. Perhaps our thirsty camels had smelt the water and this had started the stampede. We fashioned rough splints from branches and set his leg. There seemed little left but splintered bone. Bin Shuas crouched beside him, keeping the flies off his face, while others sat round discussing whether he would live or die. Occasionally a man would shake his head and say sorrowfully, "Masin didn't deserve this." Then they rose and set about their tasks, watering the camels and cooking food. In the evening we discussed what we must do. They said that Masin could not be moved. He must stay here till he recovered or till he died, and the Rashid must remain with him. He had killed many men, especially from the Tsar, and if his enemies heard that he was lying helpless here, they would come from afar to kill him. During the past days, I had let the news leak out that I planned to cross the empty quarter. I knew from Bin Gabina that I could count on the Rashid. Sultan and Musalim had both said they would come with me, and were insistent that I should take some of the Beit Katir, for they were jealous of the Rashid. Now everything was changed. I was in the hands of the Beit Katir, and I wondered whether they would still be eager for this journey. Sultan soon suggested that we should travel eastwards, through the Sama sands, where I had been the year before, and perhaps visit the quicksands of al-Samim, which he knew I was anxious to see. I went to bed disconsolate, certain that my plans were wrecked. Next morning, Bin Kabina told me that the Rashid had agreed that he and Al-Auf should go with me, but asked that I should lend the others 2 of my service rifles and enough ammunition. I willingly agreed. Masin seemed better and drank a little milk. I promised him that I would remain with him till he was on the mend, and I gave him another injection of morphia, for he was still in great pain. I then spoke to Sultan, hinting that as the Beit Katir would not come with me across the sands, I should send bin Kabina to find me more Rashid. He protested, "Why do you speak like this, Mubarak? Listen to me. Have I not promised to take you across the sands? I, Sultan, what do you want with the Rashid anyway? You know the Beit Katir, old friends, your companions of last year. Did we fail you then? By God, Mubarak, why do you doubt us now?" I remained at Mukshin for 9 days. The extensive but shallow depression where the al-Hayt ends, against the sands, was well wooded with gaff and tamarisk, and on the surrounding plains there were plenty of arid salt bushes, which are good food for camels as long as water is available. Near the well there was a dense grove of untended palms, whose dates are collected in September by the Al-Katir tribes. Among the palms was a salt-encrusted ditch of very brackish water, 300 yards long, and in the middle of it a small spring of fresher water, just fit to drink. Usually, Bedou lop tall trees to provide food for their camels, but the gaff trees here were unmutilated, for Mukshin is a hauta, where no tree may be cut. On my way to the Hadramut, I had passed several of these hautas, probably once the sacred groves of some forgotten cult. We would ride down a wadi and camp under trees in no way remarkable from others which we had passed, but I would be warned not to damage them, for this was a hauta. The Bedou believed that to ignore this prohibition would be to incur misfortune and possibly even death. Mukshin was distinguished from other hautas, since hares might not be killed here. Even in the sands of Ghanim, where there was no hauta, the Bedou would not eat hares, although elsewhere they ate their meat with relish. The ban did not include gazelle. I remember being told in the Hajjaz that hunting and cutting wood were both forbidden within the sanctuary around Mecca. In the evening, after we had fed, we heard angry voices behind us where the Rashid sat around Mahsin. Bin Kabina and I went over to them, and soon everyone in the camp was there. Amir was shouting at bin Makhluk, and while I watched, he snatched his headcloth from his head and threw it at his feet. Many people were talking, and it was difficult to make out what the row was about. Among Bedou, anyone, however young, can always express his opinion, and will probably do so even if the argument has got nothing to do with him. No Bedou would ever think of saying, "For God's sake, mind your own business," for he would accept the fact that anything that concerned him concerned everyone else in the community. Eventually, I gathered that some weeks earlier, Amir had lost a camel, and bin Makhluk had offered to look for it, provided Amir promised him a reward of 5 rials if he found it. Amir now maintained that bin Makhluk had known all the time where the camel was, and he refused to hand over the money he had promised. Finally, the matter was referred to Tamtam, who was respected by the Rashid for his great age and shrewdness. He decided that Amir should pay the money, provided that bin Makhluk swore on the tomb of Al-Juhari, which was on the coast several days' journey to the west of Salala, that he had not known where the camel was when he had offered to look for it. Both of them accepted the judgment, and were soon helping each other to mend a saddle. Disputes are generally settled among the Bedou by one side or the other swearing an oath on a saint's tomb to the truth of their statement. And it is for the arbitrators to decide which side should be asked to take the oath. Few Bedou would swear falsely on one of these tombs, of which there are several along the coast and in the Hadramut. During the days that I was at Mukshin, my companions often asked me for medicines. Bedou suffer much from headaches and stomach trouble. Sometimes my aspirin worked, but if not, the sufferer would get someone to brand him, usually on his heels, and would announce a little later that his headache was now gone, and that the old Bedou remedies were better than the Christians' pills. Bedou cauterized themselves and their camels for nearly every ill. Their bellies, chests, and backs are often crisscrossed with the ensuing scars. I had heard that many years ago a British cargo steamer was shipwrecked on the southern coast of Arabia. A few survivors were picked up by some Janouba, who, hoping no doubt for a reward, took them eventually to Muscat. Camel's milk and dates had given the Englishmen acute diarrhea, and the Bedou, despite their protests, forcibly cauterized them. They eventually arrived at Muscat, nearly killed by dysentery and this primitive treatment. One of the Beit Katir had an exposed nerve in a back tooth, which he asked me to remove. I hate taking out teeth, especially as they're usually nothing but blackened shells. This one was fairly sound, however, and I removed it without difficulty, the patient lying on the ground with his head firmly held between someone's knees. Musalim was suffering from severe constipation. I gave him a powerful dose of Epsom salts, but when this did not work at once, he resorted to the Bedou remedy of Hamra. He lay on the ground while a dozen of his friends knelt round him in a circle chanting. Old Tamtam led the singing, which got faster and faster as the participants got more and more excited. At intervals, one of the singers would lean forward and take up a mouthful of flesh from Musalim's stomach, making a curious bubbling noise as he did so. Musalim's bowels were loosed soon after this. I gave the credit to the Epsom salts, while they claimed it for the Hamra. Gazelle were plentiful at Mukshin. Musalim and Bim Chuas shot us meat each day, so we fed well, indeed too well. I was worried about our rations, especially as I should now have to leave enough food with Mahsin and the Rashid. All Bedou are improvident, and my companions cooked lavish meals from our fast dwindling supplies. I encouraged them to eat the rice which they preferred, since this would be of little use to me during the waterless journey which lay ahead. Bedou have no desire for variety in their meals, and would happily eat the same food twice a day for months, judging it not by its quality, but by its quantity. I tried once to vary the sameness of our food. Musalim had shot a gazelle, and I cooked an elaborate and, I thought, excellent lunch. Unfortunately, Bin Turkia had gone off to look for a camel and had not come back till after dark, by which time the grilled meat was a congealed mess, liberally sprinkled with sand. The others ate it, but declared unanimously that they preferred the boiled meat and soup which Musalim cooked. After incessant discussions, we decided that Bin Kabina, Al-Auf, Sultan, Musalim, Mabhout, Bin Turkia, young Said, the boy who had suffered from the evil spirit, and five other Beit Katir should accompany me. I was anxious to take a smaller party, with only the best camels, but Sultan said that we could change the worst camels with the Beit Musan, whose herds were in the sands a few days distant. He argued that it would be dangerous for us to be a small party on the far side of the sands, where the Al-Bufala of Abu Dhabi and the Bin Maktoum of Dubai were at war, and also when we travelled back through the Duru country in Oman. He told me that the Duru, after hearing I had visited Mukshin last year, had vowed that they would allow no infidel to travel in their country. We settled to meet the main party again at Bai, near the southern coast, in 2 months' time. On the 24th of November, we spent a busy day redividing our rations, looking to water skins, and watering the camels. I had bought Bin Shua's camel for Bin Kabina to ride. I paid the equivalent of £25, which was a lot more than she was really worth. But she was a fine animal in excellent condition, and in milk. For myself, I had selected a powerful dark-coloured camel from Darfur, which belonged to Musalim, and was one of the spares we had with us. She was a rough ride, but Alaf said she would go well in the sands when once she was used to them. He himself was mounted on a magnificent but almost uncontrollable animal, riding her on a thin chain fastened to a ring in her nose. This camel was from Mahsin's herd, and our camel guards had found her grazing to the east of the well. Camel theft, as opposed to raiding, was almost unknown here, and these Bedou often left their animals free to roam for weeks on end. If a camel turned up at a well, anyone there would give her a drink. Most of our other camels were in poor condition. I had a final look at Mahsin, who was much better. For several days he had refused food, but now he was eating again. Bin Shuas would be able to shoot meat for him, and one of the Rashid camels was in milk. Then we loaded up, and after saying goodbye to the others, we set off into the sands. As I approached my camel to take her halter, she kicked sideways at me, grazing the skin. Had the kick landed, it would have broken my leg. We camped a few miles away. At last, I had started on my journey across the empty quarter. 6. On the edge of the empty quarter. We water for the last time at Kaur bin Atarit in Ghanim and travel to Ramlat al-Ghaffa. After our evening meal, I had a long talk with Muhammad al-Auf. He was the only one of our party who had been across the sands and knew what conditions were like on the other side. He was quiet and reserved and inspired me with confidence. The Beit Katir were jealous of him, and he was anxious not to assume responsibility as guide until we had left the area which they knew. Young Said, who was the son of the Beit Masan Sheikh, could take us as far as Ramlat al-Ghaffa. He knew these sands, but the rest of the Beit Katir had only been on the edge of them when travelling with me the year before. I knew that Sultan and the others would join me at once if they saw me talking to Al-Auf. He and I therefore told the others that we were going to round up the grazing camels. Taking our rifles, we walked off into the desert, hunted round until we found the camels, and then sat and talked. I asked Al-Auf when he had crossed the eastern sands. He said, 2 years ago. I know them. When I pressed him for details of his journey, he smiled and repeated, I know them. And I felt sure he did. He said that if we could cross the formidable Uruk al-Shaiba, which he described as successive mountains of sand, we should arrive at Dafara, where, in the palm groves of Liwa, there were wells and villages. I had vaguely heard of Dafara. To the southern Bedu, it stood for the Ultima Thule, as far as Dafara, they said, to imply the limits of the known world. Al-Auf described Liwa to me as we sat there in the dark. It sounded very exciting, an oasis with palm groves and villages which extended for 2 days' camel journey. I knew that no European had ever been there, and that it must be bigger than Jabrin, which Cheeseman had discovered in 1924. Al-Auf reckoned that it would take us a month to get there, and was worried about the Beit Katir camels, which were in poor condition. He said, They will never get across the Uruk al-Shaiba. I asked if there was no way round these sands, and he said, No. Only if we went far to the west, by Dakaka, where Thomas crossed. There the sands are easy. He told me that to the east the Uruk al-Shaiba ran into the dangerous quicksands of al-Samim, the mother of poison. Bertram Thomas had heard of al-Samim, and believed that the legendary quicksands of the Bahr al-Safi, which von Ried, the Bavarian traveller, claimed to have discovered to the north of the Hadramut in 1843, would eventually be identified with it. There were fascinating problems to be solved in the desert ahead of us. But could we get there? I estimated that we should have to cross 400 miles of desert before we reached Liwa. Once more we discussed camels, distances, food and water. We were seriously short of food. We had started from Mukshin with 200 pounds of flour, rice for 2 meals, one of which was eaten, a few handfuls of maize and a little butter, coffee, sugar and tea. This must last 12 of us for at least a month, which was 1/2 pound of flour a day each, and nothing else. I thought bitterly of the food which the Arabs had squandered on the way to Mukshin. We should be very hungry. We could probably carry enough water for 20 days, if we rationed ourselves to a quart a day for each person. 20 waterless days was the very limit that camels would stand, travelling for long hours across heavy sands. And they would only do this if they found grazing. Should we find grazing? It is the continual problem which faces the Bedu. If we did not find it, the camels would collapse, and that would be the end of us all. It is not hunger, nor is it thirst that frightens the Bedu. They maintain that riding they can survive in cold weather for 7 days without food or water. It is the possible collapse of their camels which haunts them. If this happens, death is certain. I asked Alaf again what he thought. Would we find grazing?
God knows, he answered. There is grazing as far as Ramnat al-Gaffa from rain 2 years ago. Beyond that, who knows?
He smiled and added,
We will find something.
We rose and went back to the camp to sleep.
But I lay awake for a long time. The journey ahead of us seemed very formidable, and I was doubtful of the Beit Katir.
In the morning we allowed the camels to feed for a while on the guff trees which grew round our camping place. Musalim had shot a gazelle the day before, and we had eaten only half the meat. He had placed the rest in a low bush to keep it out of the sand, and when we woke it was gone. Tracks showed that a fox had taken it. I was angry, for this was the last meat we were likely to have for very many days. Musalim followed the tracks, and unearthed most of the meat where the fox had buried it under another bush. We brushed the sand off it, thankful to have recovered it. After we had saddled, we rode northward to Ghanim. This country was familiar to me, from my visit of the year before. Isolated dunes, 200 or 300 feet in height, rose in apparently haphazard confusion from the desert floor. These enormous piles of sand, produced by vagaries of the winds which blew there, conformed to no known rule of sand formation. The Bedou call them Kaid. I have only seen them in the southeastern sands, and in modified form around Liwa. These Kaid are known individually to the Bedou, for each dune has its own shape, which does not change perceptibly with the years. But all of them have certain features in common. Here, in every case, it was the northern face which was steep. On this side, the sand fell away from beneath the summit in an unbroken wall, set at as steep an angle as the grains of sand would lie. Down this face, small avalanches constantly subsided, each fall leaving a temporary, light-coloured smear upon the surface of the sand. On either side of this face, sharp-crested ridges swept down in undulating curves, and behind them were other alternating ridges and troughs, smaller and more involved as they became farther from the main face. The sand on the lower slopes at the back of the dune was firm, and rose and fell in broad, sinuous trenches, or was dimpled with shallow hollows. The surface of the sand was marked with diminutive ripples, of which the ridges were built from the heavier and darker grains, while the hollows were filled with the smaller, paler-coloured stuff. Continuously the wind shifted the sand, separating the heavier from the lighter grains, which are always of different colour. Only once did I notice sands where the large were paler than the small. Although they are the least numerous, it is the large grains which give the prevailing hue to the landscape. Disturb the surface of the sand, and the underlying paleness is immediately revealed. It is this blending of two colours which gives such depth and richness to the sands. Gold with silver, orange with cream, brick red with white, burnt brown with pink, yellow with grey. They have an infinite variety of shades and colours. We reached the well of Kaab bin Atarit, discovered by some forgotten Bedou but still bearing his name, on the evening of the 27th of November, 4 days after leaving Mukshin. The shallow well was in the hard, white gypsum floor that underlay the sands, and was on the north side of a high dune. It was drifted in, but, using our hands and the few basins and pots which we had with us, we dug it out before nightfall.
The water tasted brackish, as I had expected, and I knew that the taste would grow worse the longer we kept the water in the skins. Surprisingly, it was only mildly purgative, although it contained magnesium sulphate mixed with calcium and common salt.
Next day Saeed and two others went to look for the Beit Musan at Bir Halu, the sweet well. I knew from the year before that the name was misleading, and that the water of Bir Halu tasted as foul as the water of Kaab bin Atarit. I climbed the summit of the dune and lay peacefully in the sun, 400 feet above the well. A craving for privacy is something which Bedu will never understand, something which they will always instinctively mistrust. I have often been asked by Englishmen if I was never lonely in the desert, and I have wondered how many minutes I have spent by myself in the years that I have lived there. It is true that the worst loneliness is to be lonely in a crowd. I have been lonely at school, and in European towns where I knew nobody, but I have never been lonely among Arabs. I have arrived in their towns where I was unknown, and I have walked into the bazaar and greeted a shopkeeper. He has invited me to sit beside him in his shop and sent for tea. Other people have come along and joined us. They have asked me who I was, where I came from, and innumerable questions which we should never ask a stranger. Then one of them has said, "Come and lunch," and at lunch I have met other Arabs, and someone else has asked me to dinner. I have wondered sadly what Arabs brought up in this tradition have thought when they visited England, and I have hoped that they realized that we are as unfriendly to each other as we must appear to be to them. I watched Bin Kabina walking along the arête of sand which swept upwards to the summit where I sat. He carried the service rifle which I had lent him for this journey. He joined me and sat talking while he stripped the bolt. Bedu loved taking rifles to pieces. He told me that he was going to buy a rifle with the money I should give him, and I chaffed him, asking him if he had his eye on the rifle which he had borrowed when he came with me to the Hadramut. Then he asked me if I had met Thomas, the only other Englishman who had been with his tribe. I told him that I had, and later, when he had stopped talking and gone to sleep, I thought about the journey that Thomas had made. When he crossed this desert, it offered the final and greatest prize of Arabian exploration. Doughty and other famous Arabian travellers had dreamt of this achievement, but the realization of the dream was reserved for Thomas and Philby, whose names will always be remembered together in connection with the crossing of the Empty Quarter, as the names of Amundsen and Scott will be associated with the South Pole. Bertram Thomas proved that this desert was not impassable, as was once supposed. Its object was to cross the Empty Quarter, and naturally he crossed it by the easiest way, where the dunes were small and the wells, known to his Rashid guides, were frequent. Today this route would offer no real difficulty, because the traveller would know what lay ahead of him. But I knew that to minimize Thomas's achievement by saying that his route proved easy would be as unjustifiable as to depreciate the first ascent of a great mountain because it was climbed by the easiest face. Philby's route had obviously been far more difficult, and the 400 miles between wells which he covered across the western sands at the end of his journey must always remain an epic of desert travel. Before he started from Riyadh, he had heard that Thomas had already crossed from Darfur to Qatar. Although he was bitterly disappointed, he continued, undeterred with his plans, and carried out a journey which the discerning will regard as the greater of the two. Yet Philby had certain advantages which were denied to Thomas. Once he had obtained Ibn Saud's permission to undertake the journey, and it was the king's delay in granting this permission that lost him the race, he had behind him the king's far-reaching authority. As a Muslim, with the backing of the widely feared Ibn Jalawi, governor of the Hassa, he could pass safely through the territory of the powerful Murra, whereas Thomas ran his greatest risk from this tribe, many of whom were extremely fanatical. Thomas had to make all his preparations himself. The Sultan of Muscat and his Wali in Salalah were friendly, but their effective authority did not extend as far as the Qara Mountains. He discovered from experience which tribes could be of use to him. But as a Christian, he was at first suspected and disliked. The measure of his achievement was that he won the confidence of these tribesmen, and with no authority behind him, persuaded them, by patience and fair dealing, to take him across the sands. The sun was getting low. Bin Kabina was still asleep. I touched him to wake him, and in one movement he was on his feet with his dagger drawn. I had forgotten that to touch a sleeping Bedou is usually to jerk him awake, ready instinctively to fight for his life. I raced him down the dune face, floundering through the avalanching sand, and then we walked across to the well where the others had filled the water skins, ready for our departure in the morning. There were 14 of these skins, but several of them were small. Said and the others had come back. They had found nobody at Bir Halu, and told us that the Beit Musan and a family of Beit Imani had been there and had left 5 days ago, travelling north-east towards Ramlat al-Gaffa. They gave us the names of the individual Arabs who had been there, and told us which camels they had with them. All this they had read from the tracts which they found. Said looked wretched, and when I asked him what was wrong, he confessed that he had a severe pain in his stomach. I offered him some soda mint tablets, but he scorned them. Later I saw him drinking camel's urine, which Sultan recommended. Musalim made porridge for our evening meal, the only meal of the day. From now on, we should be eating gritty lumps of unleavened bread, smeared with a little butter. We assembled to feed, and Binkabina poured water over our outstretched hands. This was the last time we should wash, even our hands, until we reached the wells in Dafara. Mabhout moved a rug for us to sit on, and uncovered one of the large pale green scorpions that are plentiful in the sands, wherever there is any vegetation. I always hoped I would not tread on one with my bare feet. In Abyssinia I had once put on my trousers with a scorpion inside them, and knew how painful their sting could be. I was also afraid of treading on a snake when I fetched the camels after dark. There were plenty of them about. Most of them were horned vipers, but there was also a small burrowing snake, a diminutive boa, which was harmless. A year before, one of these snakes had burrowed its way out of the sand underneath one of the Rashid as he sat with us beside the fire. He was known thereafter as the father of the snake, and was not allowed to forget his momentary panic. But it was the spiders I really loathed, and they were common in all but the most arid places. They were as much as 3 inches across, with hairy reddish legs and pendulous bodies, and they scuttled about in the firelight. I saw one now, and tried to kill it, but it escaped. A little later, Binkabina tickled the back of my neck, and thinking it was this spider, I jumped convulsively and upset my tea. Laughingly, the others assured me that these spiders were harmless, which I already knew, but this knowledge did not lessen the revulsion which I felt for them. A cold wind blew in gusts across the desert, charged with a fine spray of sand. The stars were very bright. We piled more wood upon the fire, long snake-like roots of tribulus and heliotrope, which we had dragged out of the sand. I was still hungry. I knew that I should be hungry for weeks, perhaps months. But tonight there was plenty of water, so I told Binkabina to make more coffee and tea. The others were busy in the firelight, sewing a buckle on a cartridge belt, patching a rent in a shirt, seeing to a saddle, cleaning a rifle, or plaiting a rope. Sultan was digging with the point of a dagger in the horny sole of his foot, looking for a thorn, and Alaf was shaping me a new camel stick. These sticks are brittle, and I had broken mine the day before. While he heated the abal root, which he had selected, before bending its end to make a crook, he spoke of the fighting on the Tushul coast. I gathered that the Albul Falah could call on the tribes in time of need, Alaf explained. The Bin Maktum of Dubai would have to pay for our service. We owe them no loyalty. The Albul Falah are different. If one of that family, even a child, gave me an order, it would be awkward to refuse. He added with a grin, "Being a Bedou, I expect I should, unless it suited me." I gathered that the Albul Falah had recently been successful in several raids. It was extraordinary how widely news travelled in the desert. Alaf had heard this news from two of his kinsmen when they had returned to the southern steppes with a rifle and 3 camels which they had captured. These men had travelled 700 miles across the sands before they met him. He had then come 400 miles to Mukshin, and now the Beit Katir would carry the news down to Bai on the southern coast, a further 200 miles, and from there others would take it up into Amman. Later my companions spoke of camels and grazing, and of how to cure mange, of the price of flour and salala, of when the dhows might be expected to arrive there with dates, and of an old man who had died recently in Gaidat, on the Mahra coast. They agreed that he had been skilful in curing sickness with his spells, and cited cases. Musalim spoke of the festivities he had watched at a slave's wedding in Salala, and Bin Turkia described the feasting and dancing at a recent circumcision ceremony among the Mahra. Said said, "By God, Ali's son made a fuss when they cut him. He cried out like a woman." The others laughed, and some of them exclaimed, "God blacken his face." I realized that this wretched boy's failure would soon be known far and wide among the Bedou. Musalim next told a long story about an oryx hunt, which I had heard at least 3 times before. They discussed the Dharm raids and Bin al-Kamam's mission to seek a truce. Then Bin Kabina described the meals which he had eaten when he was with me in the Hadramut, probably the first time in his life that he had had enough to eat. During the months ahead we were to talk often of food, of meals which we had eaten, and of others which we planned. At Mukshin my companions had spoken of women, for then they were full-fed and eating meat. The Bedou are a vigorous race with strong passions, and their talk of sex is vivid and frank, but never obscene. Similarly, their swearing is direct and purposeful. "God's curse on you. May God destroy your house. Cursed of your 2 parents. May raiders get you." Not the meaningless obscenities which pass for cursing among the gutter-bred Arabs of the towns. But we seldom spoke of sex, for starving men dream of food, not of women, and our bodies were generally too tired to lust. Homosexuality is common among most Arabs, especially in the towns, but it is very rare among the Bedou, who, of all Arabs, have the most excuse for indulging in this practice, since they spend long months away from their women. Lawrence described in 7 Pillars of Wisdom how his escort made use of each other to slake their needs, but those men were villagers from the oasis, not Bedou. Glubb, who knows more about the Bedou than any other European has ever known, once told me that active homosexuality among them was almost unknown. I myself could not have lived as I did with my companions and been unaware of it had it existed among them. We lived too close together. Yet during all the time I was with them, I saw no sign of it. Nor did they talk about it. They sometimes joked about goats, but never about boys. Only 2 times in 5 years did I ever hear them mention the subject. Once, when we were staying in a town on the Trucial coast, Bin Kabina pointed out 2 youths, one of whom was a slave, and said that they were sometimes used by the sheikh's retainers. He evidently thought the practice both ridiculous and obscene. On the other occasion, Bin al-Kamam described an execution which he had watched in Riyadh. The man, one of the Habab from the Hajjaz, had been sentenced to death for raping a boy. None of my companions showed the slightest sympathy for him. Instead, they muttered, "It was a just sentence. God blacken his face. He deserved to die." Bin al-Kamam said, "We had come across to Riyadh from the Wadi Dawasir. Said was with me, and Muhammad bin Bakit." And when I looked at him in inquiry, he said, "No, you don't know Muhammad. You have never met him. He spends his time in the Dakaka sands." He went on, "It was Friday, and we had gone into the town to buy provisions, for we planned to leave next day for the Hassa. We had camped a little way outside the town. It was after the midday prayers, and the market square was crowded. They brought the man out from prison, and as they led him through the crowd, he chanted over and over again, 'There is no God but God, and Muhammad is the prophet of God.' He was quite unafraid. He was a young man, very good-looking and dressed in freshly washed white clothes. He had darkened his eyelids with kohl and stained his palms with henna, as we do for a wedding. In the centre of the square they told him to kneel, and the executioner, a large slave, very black,
dressed in a robe, which by God was worth a camel, drew his sword, and fastened back his long white shirt sleeve to bare his right arm. Then his assistant pricked the condemned man in the side, and as he stiffened, the executioner cut off his head with one blow. The head jumped among the crowd, and the blood spouted an arm's length into the air as the body collapsed. They left it lying there till sunset for the crowd to look at. I asked Bin al-Kamam what his feelings were as he watched, and he said, "It made me feel quite sick." In the morning we gave the camels another drink. Several of them, accustomed to clean-tasting water in Darfur, refused to touch this bitter stuff. We held their nostrils, but they still refused, and finally we poured it down their throats by force. It was the last water we should find till we reached Darfur. Some of the skins had leaked a little. We filled them up and plugged the tiny dribbling holes. The Arabs said their midday prayers, and then we loaded our camels and led them away between the golden dunes. We went on foot, for the full skins were heavy on their backs. It was the 29th of November. We travelled northeast towards Ramnat al-Gaffa, where we hoped to find the Beit Musan and to change the weakest of our camels. The going was easy, along gravel flats, splashed with outcrops of white gypsum and fringed with bright green salt bushes. We camped at sunset, but there was nothing for our camels to eat. One of them cast a 9-month-old calf. They carry their young for a year. I noticed that Salim bin Turkia took water for the ritual ablutions before he prayed. I protested, saying he should use sand, as is the custom when water is short, and added that we should not have enough to drink if it was used for washing. He said, "It is better to pray than to drink." I answered that he would not be doing either in a week's time if he wasted water. This incident worried me. It showed that some of the Beit Katir had not begun to realize how narrow was our margin of safety. In the evening I warned them that Darfur was twice as far from Ka'b bin Atharit as was Salala. Sultan remarked gloomily, "In that case, neither we nor our camels will ever live to see it." The next afternoon we found a little parched herbage on the flank of a high dune. We let our camels graze for 2 hours, and then continued until dark. Throughout the day, my companions had gathered any plants they had seen, to feed their camels as they went along. It did not matter how high up on a dune a plant was growing, someone was sure to dismount, scramble up, and collect it. They always did this, however long or tiring the march might be. Where we camped, the dunes were very big, whale-backed massifs, rising above white plains of powdery gypsum. There was no warmth in this sterile scene. It was bleak and cheerless and curiously arctic in appearance. Twice I woke during the night, and each time I saw Sultan brooding over the fire. We did another long day's marching, 10 hours without a stop. There was nothing to stop for among these lifeless dunes. We had picked up the Beit Musan tracks and were following them. In the evening we found a little vegetation. We started again soon after sunrise. As Sultan seemed gloomy and little inclined for conversation, I rode beside Alaf. He sat his restive, half-tamed camel with easy mastery, and consciously anticipating her fretful movements, a confident, commanding figure, typical of a people whom no hardship can daunt. I asked him whether it rained more often in summer or in the winter, and he said, "It seems to have changed since I was a boy. Then I remember we got more rain in the summer. Now we expect it in the winter. But as you can see, there is not much at any time. The trouble is that when it does fall, it is usually very local, and the grazing is difficult to find." I asked how much rain was required to produce grazing, and he answered, "It is of no use if it does not go into the sand this far," and he indicated his elbow. "How long does it have to rain to do that? A heavy shower is enough. That would produce grazing that was better than nothing. But it would die within the year unless there were more rain. If we get really good rain, a whole day and night of rain, the grazing will remain green for 3 and even 4 years."
"Do you mean without any more rain?"
Yes, without another drop. It depends, of course, on the sands. Some are better than others. We divide all the sands into red and white. We should call these sands white. The red ones produce the best grazing. The red downs in Dakakar are the best of all. You ought to go and see them sometime, Mubarak. They are wonderful sands. After a pause, he went on. We like winter rain best. It generally lasts longer. Summer storms, it is true, are often heavier, but the great heat at that time of year kills the seedlings, unless the rain has been heavy. However, praise be to God, rain is rain whenever it comes. He pointed to some dead tribulus. Do you see that, Zahra? You would think it was quite dead, wouldn't you? But it's only got to rain, and a month later it will be green and covered with flowers. It takes years of drought to kill these plants. They have such tremendously long roots. In a place where the plants really are dead, like the Al-Ait, which we saw the other day, the vegetation comes up again from seeds when at last it does rain. It does not matter how long they have lain in the sand. I said, take, for instance, these Beit Musan, whose tracks we are following. How long will they be able to stay here without water? Al-Auf answered, it depends on how good the grazing is. On good grazing, they could remain here from the late autumn until the spring. Of course, when the weather gets hot, they will have to move back to within reach of the wells. So, they may be here for 6 or 7 months without any water. What do they eat? Camel's milk is their food and drink. As long as there is plenty of milk, the Bedou want nothing more.
Don't the camels ever get thirsty?
He answered. If you loosed a camel that was dying of thirst on fresh green grazing, not only would she recover from her thirst, but she would be fat within 2 months. Sometimes a camel gets so fat that her hump splits, and then she dies.
How do you know where you will find grazing?
In the autumn, while they are still on the wells, the Arabs send out scouts to look for it. These scouts must be good men, accustomed to endure, and their camels must be the best. During the summer, we may have seen clouds or lightning in the distance, or, while we are searching the desert, we may find tracks of oryx or rim, all going in one direction, and follow them. We may go back to look at the grazing we had been on the year before, or other grazing we had found during the winter. If there is grazing in the desert, we probably find it. We are Bedou. We know the desert.
How do you manage for grazing in the summer?
Yes, that is the difficulty. Often there is none round the wells, and we have to take the camels long distances to water them.
How long will a camel last without water in summer?
Again, it depends on the grazing. They will last longer in the wadis, where they can get some shade from the trees. Under those conditions, they will go for a week without a drink. In the sands, we try to water them every 2 or 3 days. Life is hard for the Bedou in the summer, Mubarak. Sometimes we are camped on wells which are so bitter that we can only drink the water mixed with milk. We water the camels and cannot drink the water ourselves. We splash it over us to cool us while we work, and our bodies get covered with sores. Watering the camels is hard work. They are thirsty and drink a lot, and the sun is hot. It is worse when the wind blows. Then it is like a furnace. Even when we stop to rest, there is no shade on these wells in the sand. Only the Bedou could endure this life.
4 hours later, we came to large red dunes, set close together. There were green plants growing there as the result of heavy rain, which had fallen 2 years before. A little later, we saw camels of the Beit Musan, and a herds boy who was tending them. We camped in a hollow and loosed our camels to revel among the juicy shrubs. Larks were singing round our camping place. Butterflies flitted from plant to plant, lizards scuttled about, and small black beetles walked laboriously across the sand. We had seen a hare that morning, and the tracks of gazelle. The sand around us was still marked, where jabirs and other small rodents had scampered about during the night. I wondered how they got here, how they had located this small green island in the enormous emptiness which surrounded it. Sultan, Muslim, and several others had gone off with the herds boy to the Beit Musan encampment. Al-Auf was herding the camels. Several people were sleeping, their faces covered with their headcloths,